Hello, and welcome to the 17th episode of Film Club with Casper. I'm Casper Salmon, and with me today to discuss Werner Herzog's 1979 film Nosferatu, The Vampire, is Hilary Davidson, a dress historian, curator, and archaeologist. Hiya, Hilary.
Hi, Casper.
How are you?
I am very well, thank you.
It's lovely to have you on. What a film you've picked for our pandemic times.
It really struck me. When I was watching it again, it's so apt for now, although that completely didn't cross my mind when we were talking about it.
Yeah. So I had already watched Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula in the first, well, rewatched in the first lockdown. And already when I watched that, I was thinking to myself, my God, all of this is happening because of a bat, this madness. And again in Herzog's film, the sort of craziness that descends on a small town it has a real kind of plague parable going on.
Completely. And I really like the idea as well that what the vampire brings isn't necessarily sort of the blood-sucking and the individualism, that this plague comes with him and kind of spreads out far beyond his individual ken. And this sense of, you know, that an extraordinary visual effect of the rats. And yeah. You never actually see anybody sick, but you can see, you know, the effects of it. And it's this beautiful kind of intercut that evokes so much of, as you say, how the town goes mad. Everybody goes mad, you know. It's Alice in Wonderland. We're all mad here. But it's kind of eerie and not explicit at the same time.
Yeah, and there's a kind of xenophobic panic that takes hold, of course, the fear of the other, which particularly being set in Germany, obviously, has its own kind of... what's the word? Connotations.
Yes. Yes. Very much so.
That's a crazy thing. Okay, so perhaps shall I do a few, a little minute on the film itself, just to kind of recap, and then we can get going, particularly on the costumes, your area of specialty. So the film is a remake, a loving remake of Murnau's 1920. Silent Nosferatu, with Max Schreck as Count Orlok. Murnau wasn't allowed to use Dracula and various other names from the original book. And it has Klaus Kinski as Dracula, Isabella Gianni as Lucy Harker, and Bruno Ganz in, I guess, the other lead role, as Jonathan. And what are your overall thoughts about the film? What made you pick it for a start?
Well, it's one of my favourite films, and I first discovered it in about the mid-90s, I think. I had an Isabella Gianni obsession. I mean, why wouldn't you? She's a goddess. But it also, I mean, I'm a big romantic with a big taste for the gothic. So the idea of a vampire film starring Isabella Gianni was just, you know, irresistible. Yes. And I can't even remember where I saw it first. I think I might have got it on DVD or video or something. And I just loved the sensibility. I think I saw the Murnau after I saw the remake, but I just thought it was so incredibly evocative and dreamy, and it's something that could have, I think, very easily been very silly or gone wrong, and it just works on every level. There's a kind of a seriousness and a solemnity to it, as well as what I feel is it is a kind of a dream film, and it's one of the best evocations of that sense of dream where kind of images happen and you find yourself in the next scene without quite knowing where you get there. And, you know, combined with its luminous beauty, I'm always a sucker for great beauty and aesthetic shine in cinema, and I just think it's so beautifully composed and so painterly, and then of course you have this radiant beauty of Isabella Gianni, which is just so perfect for the part. And I just found that a strange and wonderful and very romantic, evocative film, and I've loved it ever since.
Yeah, it is incredibly beautiful from a pictorial point of view. And yet it's not at all indulgent, is it? I feel like it has an almost, documentary feel at times. Mm. I mean, Herzog goes for realism isn't quite the word, because, as you say, there is something dreamlike to it, but it feels earthy, and there's detail there, and there's process as well. I'm thinking about when Harker travels to see Dracula, his journey.
I love that sequence.
Yeah. That is stunning, because it feels so committed.
And it's the word that kept coming to me when I was watching it was quiet. And it's very domestic as well, which is not something, again, you expect to say of something that's, essentially a Dracula adaptation, but all of these little details, the faces of the gypsies and the kittens playing with the fruit, and it's all in tiny, small gestures and details that are very intimate, and as you say, aren't kind of flamboyant and flashy, but together conjure a much bigger mood than they might suggest.
Yeah, and it just makes the film stand out from the horror. I mean, it's not a horror film, really.
No.
It's a film of alienation and of otherness, kind of breaking through into a richly described world. So that has its own really quite striking effect, because it's a sort of a clash. It's visiting difference and sort of comparing it to a world that has been so evocatively set up for us, I think.
This very bourgeois town, the kind of... And again, I think what Herzog does so well is... He evokes so much through absence. You know the burghers of this town. You know its kind of prosperity and its middle classness, even though he only very rarely explicitly shows it. He manages to sketch in small details that allow you to connect between them and in a sense make your own world from it, from just quite slight materials. It's almost kind of impressionist in that sense of what's actually there compared with what you get from it and how... he puts those details together.
Yeah, I think that's true. So to go back to Isabella Gianni, there's a lot going on there in her performance and also in the presentation of her. I was struck by the fact that the film pretty much begins with her. That's after a very striking and strange opening, which presents the, kind of shrunken bodies from a plague outbreak in Guanajuato, in a museum in Guanajuato, filmed by Herzog. So that gives the movie already a kind of a different quality, anchored in the real. And then it begins with Gianni, and she is so pale in this film and so otherworldly that I found her to be almost the vampire of the film, if you see what I mean.
I had exactly the same thought, that she's this mirror, like she's completely the mirror of the Count. Throughout this kind of, they're made up the same, that there's right. This kind of moon reflection theme I felt between the two of them.
Yes, whereas Harker, and especially in his costume and, his outlook is presented in these kind of rich colours, especially as he's travelling.
And she's just, Oh, she's luminous, and she comes onto the screen like a silent screen goddess.
Right.
But also like, you know, older 19th century pictures like Julia Margaret Cameron or something. And it's not a parody and it's not a performance. She somehow manages to embody kind of a quite stylized, almost like it could be overdone, the kind of the wide eyes and the excessive fainness, but it works as a sort of embodied spirit. You know, she's almost aerial, trapped in the body of a woman, which is, I think, very, very hard to do. And so much is from Ajani's physicality. You know, she's just so incredibly beautiful that I think that it gives it a gravity to the performance and a sweetness and a compassion that I think it would have been very hard to find in most other actresses.
Yeah,
I'm a huge fan, so perhaps I'm biased.
No, I like her very much, and I think she has obviously such intensity. And in casting her opposite Klaus Kinski, what you're going for are two kind of different poles of intensity and fervor, and that casting choice and the makeup and costuming make them parallels for each other, and you see that later in the film, just as Dracula is about to feast on Harker for the first time and he sinks his teeth into his neck, rather sexually, obviously. And that cuts straight to Ajani in her bed, waking from some kind of nightmare or having some vision. And that makes the two of them kin as well, I think, that cut. I'm not sure what Herzog is doing there. I feel like maybe it's to do with the alienation of her femininity, because at one point she wants to warn the townsfolk about you know, this plague, which in reality is the arrival of Dracula, and she isn't listened to. And she's not listened to by Harker when she warns him not to go on his journey. So I feel like she's somebody who is also in her own way neglected and has a sadness. So I think perhaps it comes from that.
And there's always, you know, she is talking about, she starts off with her feelings. She's all feelings. She's all, you know, the sort of the feminine qualities of intuition. And she has this terrible foreboding before Jonathan goes away. And she intuits what to do to fix the vampire. And it's kind of the men around her are all literally saying, no, we must do this through science. But it's the heart that she has, this giant heart that will sacrifice herself for love, that balances out the absence of heart in the vampire, and in a sense they're joined through the body of Jonathan. You know, the physicality of Dracula feeding upon Jonathan and you know the presumed physicality between husband and wife, although they note they have, you know, two separate beds. But this, you know, she's so much feeling that balances out sort of the lack of feeling or the absence, the void of feeling in Dracula that he also craves for, but they, in a sense, they connect through that body of this, you know, the healthy virile man,
yes,
through the pale almost disincorporated or differently corporated pair on either side of him.
Ah, that's brilliant. I love it. That's really, really good. And then how do you feel about the progression of her character as she essentially takes on Dracula and makes herself the town's salvation, in a sense? The film requires of her a sacrifice. And in the last stages, when she offers herself up to Dracula, I find the film's outlook and her performance making of this moment such a deeply sexual, but almost rather beautiful moment of connection between finally these two souls, these two bodies that were destined to each other by the film.
It's quite compassionate as well.
Yeah.
It's you know, it is sexual, but it's also, I don't want to say erotic, but there is emotion there. There is, she doesn't want to do this, but it's bigger than herself. In a sense, you know, Dracula has been living with himself for so long, that sense of self is eroded, and he, tries to take it from others. And she is willing to sacrifice her entire sense of self and entire self-preservation for others. And the way she kind of, he tries to go and she pulls him back. There's, you know, complex emotions of something almost maternal there as well.
Yeah. And that gesture of pulling him back is like some of his gestures as well towards Harker. When Harker visits him, he has kind of what feel like instinctive movements towards Harker that betray his body, that are involuntary almost.
And again, that incredible physicality of Kinski, so much of that part is, I mean, it's 4 hours in makeup every morning, but so much is the way he moves his body and this kind of the otherness and the alienness that he conveys through gesture and control and form. It's a powerfully physical performance.
Yes, and again, it's a performance that's anchored in the real. I was kind of astonished by the makeup of his character, which, as you say, took 4 hours and was a whole thing, but it's makeup that kind of differentiates him from the Max Schreck performance, which I think is much more stylized. And in Kinski's performance, he feels really human for a start. And I think the makeup, especially in close-up, is really kind of blotchy on purpose, and he feels kind of diseased in a sense, more than just an other person or another worldly, terrifying figure. He feels like somebody, disembodied. And yet real, and I feel like his sense of personal space contributes as well to the character and the way he encroaches on Harker's personal space. That whole dynamic he has with Bruno Ganz, sort of coming up to him and encroaching on his space, is really interesting and tells you so much about his character.
And again, it's this kind of it's an intimacy. It's the space that is the space next to Jonathan that is reserved for his wife, that the vampire is crossing that invisible social boundary that we all have about, you know, who gets to go where. And he's going too far. He's acting like his most intimate connection.
I was fascinated by the idea of madness in the film, I think it's really interesting how in Herzog's work he comes back again and again to figures who aren't really of their time, you know, in the his Caspar Hauser film, and even in, you know, Grizzly Man, he's talking about people who are set aside by their period and who are misunderstood. And again, here he comes back, you know, really working that theme, really, really labouring right into it. And I suppose that that has a historical quality. It must do, you know, Herzog being a German man in the mid 20th century. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, it's what's interesting about this film is that in terms of the period in which it's set, they're never explicit about it. But from the costuming, it's set in the 1840s, which is a good 57 years before Dracula was even published. So Dracula comes out in 1897, and the timing in it is debated by a lot of scholars. But people generally kind of costume it or set it in the 1880s, in that kind of, you know, high gothic Jack the Ripper, Sherlock Holmes, late Victorian period. But this goes back even further to a sort of, we're at the end of the Romantic period in the 1840s. And to shift it, it's further back in time. It almost becomes, it becomes more like a folktale, I think, than... It's in a different period of modernity to even the late 19th century. And you think about the late 19th century with all of the technologies of reproduction that have come about, so which are used to great effect in the original novel of Dracula, that, you know, Mina's always taking notes on her typewriter, and they use wax tablets, and there's photographs, and there's all of this literal representation and speed of communication and, you know, daguerreotypes and photographs, and it's a far more, I think we've even got very, very early film. So the ability to represent the world as it literally is far more pronounced when the Dracula story is written. But to take it further back, you know, he's only got the miniature of his wife, whereas in Dracula, I think he has a photograph of Mina as the character is in the
right,
book.
Yes.
So it takes on this even more dreamy, dreamlike quality, because there's no, you know, everything's written by hand. It's far more at the end of that kind of the Brothers Grimm period. The Grimm stories come out between 1812 and 1857. And I think that's a really interesting choice as well. And I've not seen it talked about in the film, but it's definitely coming out of that kind of 1830s, 1840s, the height of the Romantic period, which in a sense is having a resurgence in the 1970s as well. And I think it is very much tied in with capital R Romantic visions more than Gothic visions on screen, but also in envisaging the past.
That's really interesting. I was thinking of kind of Pied Piper of Hamelin, sort of stories when I was watching it, and I suppose that's kind of the same, of that same stripe. So how do you feel like the, you know, the costuming plays into all of this and into that kind of romantic vision? I was really struck by the styling in several ways, I guess. I suppose partly because it reminded me of kind of Northern European painting, 19th century painting.
All that kind of Caspar David Friedrich kind of Wanderer in the Sea of Clouds style of thing. What I really love about the costumes, and I loved it at the time when I first saw it, but I appreciate it even more now that, you know, I grew up to become a dress historian, is that because of the 1840s setting, the women's costumes are actually inspired by Pre-Raphaelite dress. Right. And it's one of them is taken quite literally from a painting. And I think that's quite fascinating. So I was watching the film again with a kind of an eye to the costumes, because, you know, I see all the detail whether I want to or not. Mm-hmm. And again, it's quite interesting. It's very sort of It has all the elements of 1840s costumes, and some of the details are precisely right, and Bruno Ganz's character and his costuming is lovely frock coats for the 1840s. And then some of the extras, it's not so hot. There's like little wibbles here and there, but again, the evocation is fantastic. So I kind of believe it as the period style, but really having a look at Lucy's costumes, at Isabella Gianni's costumes, it is taken from what is coming through in painting, and it gets more so the further through the film that she appears. And even when she stays with Mina, she's wearing this beautiful orange velvet tabard with long sleeves that is pure 19th century medievalism. And so I think that, you know, there's double layers going on there as well, that the costume designer, Gisela Storch, she's referencing, in a sense, what is coming through on visions of past stories, the medieval period as seen through the Pre-Raphaelite painters. And the dress that Ajani wears the most, it's a kind of a purple figured silk with green sleeves. I'm yes. pretty certain this is taken from a very famous series of photographs of Jane Morris, William Morris's wife.
Aha.
The modelling photographs that Dante Gabriel Rossetti used to paint, you know, some of his most famous pictures of her. Yeah. And then by the time we get to see her in the last actual dress that she wears, it's an exact copy of William Morris's only figurative painting, La Belle Isolde, where he painted his wife Jane in exactly this white dress with a printed pattern of pomegranates on it and red sleeves, and the designer has copied it exactly. So we've also got kind of connections in through the costuming of a romantic vision of medieval stories, and even the kind of the Tristan and Isolde story, but also the kind of I wonder if there's elements of the quite unhappy marriage between William Morris and Jane Morris, and yeah. the sort of the sense of woman as muse and woman as inspiration, and, you know, this incredibly beautiful figure who was seen and painted by a lot of men, but didn't necessarily have her own agency. She was this heroine in medieval tales that the men around her created. So now I kind of watch it and I love all these layers and these resonances, and this quite, I think it's actually quite a bold costuming choice to make, but it works so well to link in with that dreaminess. And again, that sense of some timeless folktale past that is also firmly rooted in the bourgeois 19th century.
Wow. That's absolutely fascinating. Morris, just to go back to her, she was the one with lots of flowing black hair, am I right?
Yes, yes, all of that black hair, and she's painted as Persephone and with pomegranates, and she is the Pre-Raphaelite kind of icon, yes.
Yes, yes, I do know the one you mean. That's fascinating. And towards the end, Ajani's costuming becomes much more kind of phantasmatic. She reminded
what
me
what I think of as woman running away from a castle style, you know, pure gothic yes. horror pulp novel cover, which I kind of love. She's got those like long pointy sleeves and it's got that sort of 1970s, you know, like it could almost be Hammer horror, but it's so well done that it doesn't come across like that, but it nods to it. I love that. I love it.
When I was watching the film with my flatmate and watching Ajani walk through the ruins to meet Nosferatu, I started singing Madonna's Frozen to my flatmate. If I could melt your heart, because she looks exactly like Madonna in that video, which was a weird one.
That's so true. I hadn't picked that one, but yeah, it's and you know, in a sense, like the 1970s was after we sort of get the hippie stuff coming through in the late 60s, the 1970s is a really romantic period, and it looks back to kind of all the flowing dresses of the 1930s, and we get all of that Art Nouveau revival, all that kind of Musha inspired stuff, and the long Laura Ashley dresses.
Laura Ashley, yeah.
It's a really, yeah, you know, all of the, it's kind of coming back in fashion now. But lots of long dresses, lots of flower, lots of kind of fantasy historical glamour. So I think it's sort of picking up a little bit on what's happening in the 70s while not being, I think it's a film that's aged very well. It doesn't, it looks like it's from a time, but you don't go, oh, wow, that's so 70s. It still manages to kind of keep its own aesthetic coherence and integrity.
Yeah, that's because there's no fussiness to it whatsoever, is there, or any pomp. Mm. It's not gilded. Mm. It feels so kind of so vivid and real. And I was struck by the way also to do with Harker's costuming, all of the way he is presented is kind of based on, you know, like practicality as well. I mean, these are costumes that aren't just decorative. They are kind of, you know, shown in their own setting of purpose. And I think that also plays into the way that the film is, so rich, but also, it's not flimsy, basically.
And all of the, I was just dying over the costume details in all of the Eastern European settings. I think he filmed it in Bulgaria. Sure readers, listeners can check that. But all of the kind of the gypsies and the innkeepers, everything that they're wearing is genuine Eastern European folk dress. And it's not costume, and it has this, you know, all of the linens and the embroidery and the textures, but also the way that they're worn. This is clothing that could be costumey, but it's worn as it's just worn as clothing.
And dress,
it's very natural,
yeah.
But it's dress, and it's there's a kind of a comfort to it, and it's not stagey, and it's not, oh look, here come the gypsies. Or you know, the innkeeper is wearing this. I've done a lot of work on Eastern European folk dress, and I lived in the area for quite some time. And I just think it's got that sense of realness, but quietness, but detail, but the quality that comes through in that kind of dress just adds a, what's the phrase I'm looking for? It's gravitas.
Yeah.
To it. It's simplicity, but gravitas. That's just beautiful.
Yeah. The scene where he stops at the inn and is surrounded by the innkeeper and his wife and the gypsies, the attendant gypsies, reminded me of a scene in Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, the Nuri Bilge Ceylan film. And obviously, you know, these are separate worlds, you know, that we're talking about modern Turkey and then, you know, and in this film, the kind of 19th century Bohemia that the film is set in. And yet they have the same quality of a man from the city arriving in a rural area that hasn't caught up to civilization in the same way, and it gave me exactly the same feeling of somebody traveling and discovering, you know, real customs and real faces that you might expect.
And also, I thought a fantastic sense, like often that kind of, you know, don't go to the castle scene is sort of played out as, be gone, you know, ignorant locals, I know what I'm doing, for I am civilized man.
Right.
And I thought in this it had much more of a sense of he was out of his depth, and all of the locals are like, well, we just think you're an idiot, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, go if you must, but we're not going to help you. And he was trying to be superior, but every part of their actions just showed that they were ignoring that, and, you know, they knew what was what, and if he didn't, well, that's his problem. And I really liked that too.
Yeah, I love it. I suppose another thing that I just wanted to talk about really briefly, and you might not have anything to say on this, and that's fine, was just the casting of Roland Topor as Renfield.
Yes.
Which is quite incredible, and I think does a lot to ward off the accusations of anti-Semitism that Murnau's film has had levelled at it. Because in the depiction of Dracula, well, of Orlok in Murnau's film, it does feel, and it has been called out for, like there are kind of, horrible Jewish tropes, stereotypically hook-nosed, long-fingered character presented very much as the other and a disturbance in the community. So these are anti-Semitic tropes. And I was reading about it yesterday, in a piece that I was reading, somebody said that this might have been, even unintentional on Murnau's part. And in Herzog's film, he's obviously paying loving tribute to Murnau's film. And yet there's an attendant anxiety and humanity to that depiction. And the casting of Topor, an artist of Polish-Jewish origin whose family was persecuted in the Second World War, presenting him as this crazed character, as Renfield, a fellow artist, I think there's a really conscious choice there. He's somebody that I don't really know very much about, actually, Topor, but I thought that was fascinating.
I was reading that Herzog saw him on a talk show and was so enamored of his laugh. That was one of the reasons that he cast him, because of this incredible laugh, which is actually his real laugh. And right. He loved that sort of the strange uncanniness of it. And it apparently comes through more in the English version than the German version. Because, of course, the other thing about this film is it was filmed simultaneously in English and in German. All the actors are bilingual. Isabella Gianni's mother was German, so she was raised speaking German and French. And so I love that sense as well, is that there's actually, in this one film, it exists in two simultaneous but different renditions. And you get, slightly different performances. And I haven't seen the original German, but I also wonder how the Renfield performance, if it has different resonances in the German version, which Herzog says is kind of, what did he call it, the more culturally authentic version, than it does in the English. I think that would be a really interesting character to have a look at and see if the reading changes with the language.
Yeah, that would be really, really interesting. A kind of fascinating metatextual connection, of course, yes, is that Topor was the writer of The Tenant, which was...
Ah, I didn't realize that.
It's fascinating.
My goodness.
So he wrote the novel The Tenant, which was then adapted by Polanski to the screen and starring Ajani.
Starring Ajani.
So
my goodness.
I know. And so the filming of The Tenant, which was 1976, I think, had taken place just a couple of years before this, Ajani being in this story by Topor, again, and a story very much of kind of panic and anxiety, filmed by another, middle European director who had been marked by the Second World War. Another story very much of kind of psychosexual fear and horror, and featuring Ajani again as this sort of an object, you know, a woman crystallizing those anxieties in a sense.
Which is interesting too, because, you know, although she's one of the kind of, I suppose, quintessential French actresses, her mother is German and her father is Algerian.
Yeah.
And of course, the whole context of, you know, the relationship between Algiers and France and the status of Algerians in France and the racism and othering that they experienced, plus, you know, the relationship between Germany and France. I mean, she's always been very outspoken about Algerian refugees and mm-hmm. things to do with that. But again, for someone who's you know, so French, and I think she's still got more César nominations than anyone else, she yeah. is the product of two quite complicated cultures that have complicated relationships with France. And I wonder if that, in a sense, is part of her power, is, you know, being one step to the side, unlike, say, Catherine Deneuve.
Yes, I think, or Isabelle Huppert, who,
yes.
You know, who is much more to do with a hyper-French bourgeoisie.
Yes.
Adjani, yeah, plays a kind of, plays on a different register a fervour that's lit from within that is quite different.
And it pushes her, like, often her characters are so pushed to the edge, you know, the history of Adèle H. and Camille yeah. Claudel, and even, you know, Queen Margot, where she's, you know, playing one of the Valois, which is, you know, pretty darn French. There's still uncertainty and you know, liminality and you're never quite sure where she's going to go, or Subway even, where she kind of, you know, this extremely bourgeois, extremely established woman kind of falls into the underground and yeah, she's not safe. She's not certain.
Yeah, yeah. She's an interesting figure, just to go off on one about her with you, because you're a fan. I love her screen work. Particularly in, you know, in the 70s and 80s. But then I'm intrigued that she basically fell off somewhere. I think that's probably around the time of Camille Claudel. I think around that stage, basically, well, actually, sorry, Queen Margot came after that as well. And that's
1994.
Okay, so fair enough. I'll take that one into consideration. But still, you know,
that's her last great film. Really,
it's her last great film, and her last film, I suppose, where she wasn't bigger than the project.
Yes.
And I feel like, somebody like Isabelle Huppert was, you know, kind of Adjani's rival for films around that time of the 70s and 80s, and both of them working with, you know, great directors and doing interesting stuff. But Huppert has had a career that's lasted longer and that has stayed pretty interesting, and she's worked with great directors, whereas Adjani seems to have folded in on herself, and I can't work out why that is, or I don't know. I feel like there's a kind of a vanity, sadly, that maybe crept into her performances.
She's, you know, if you look at pictures of her now, she is very preserved.
Yeah.
And it must be terrible to be a beauty that great,
yeah,
and, you know, then have to deal with getting older. But she, I mean, you know, she still looks extraordinary, but I wonder how much of that is, yes, as you say, there's sort of the myth has outgrown the woman. She was actually supposed to come out to Australia to do a performance early 2020, and she cancelled it because we had the bushfires and a whole lot of smoke. But I had a ticket and I was so looking forward to seeing Ajani on stage, you know, where she started with the Comédie Française and, you know, in the flesh. And I would love to have seen that, you know, what she was like in person and if she let the acting overcome being Isabella Gianni, as it were.
Yeah. I saw online just, I think it was last week, a rumour, which I think actually seems to be fairly founded, in fact, that she's going to be in the next François Ozon film. So that could be a fun one.
That would be great. I mean, she's on Instagram. I follow her on Instagram, so I get updates where I can. But I, you know, I had a sort of a gossipy interest in her private life as well, because she was with Daniel Day-Lewis for a number of years. Yes. They were together for about 6 years, and they had a baby in 1995, Gabriel Kane, who is all grown up now, and he's on Instagram as well, and you know, as fine looking a young man as you would expect from a child of Daniel Day-Lewis. And
he looks fab.
He looks fab. Yes, he does. But so I just wonder, you know, 1995, she had a child. She split up with Daniel Day-Lewis. And I think she also moved out of France. She moved to Switzerland. I'm sure if I dig up gossip magazines, there may be reasons for that. But I think she had a bit of a falling out with France and the French. I can't remember why. The word tax is floating through my head, but I may be making that up completely. And I just wonder if she concentrated more on her personal life for a bit and, you know, went a little bit inward and wasn't seeking out projects or was doing more things kind of locally. I haven't caught up with her in the more recent years, but I just it's interesting that, you know, Queen Margot 1994, her second child in 1995, and then we get quiescence, relative quiescence.
Yes, okay, we're on to something here. Detective work, stalking the internet for info.
Absolutely. I mean, what's the internet for, right? If not finding out about celebrity gossip, really.
On the subject of Gabriel Kane Day-Lewis, I think he's probably grown up quite a lot, but I used to watch a video that he'd done with some friends a few years back, which was him trying to embark on a career in rap, which is really, really bad. And it featured a hilarious moment where he says something about being Gabriel Kane Day-Lewis, and then he goes, "I'm going to Gabriel Kane Day-lose it."
Oh dear.
It's a real shame. Anyway, I'm sure he's I'm sure he's grown up a lot since then.
He posts adorable pictures of him and his mother on Instagram every now and then. So
okay,
you know.
Lovely.
Oh, and she was also engaged to Jean-Michel Jarre, French, you know, electronic music pioneer, but they broke up in 2004.
Didn't he go out with Charlotte Rampling as well?
I think he did, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. God. Okay.
Her Instagram says she's with someone else now. I can't remember who, but he's quite artistic. But, you know, she's coupled up. But, yeah, Jean-Michel Jarre came next.
Wow. Right.
I'm here for your Isabella Gianni gossip. You know.
This has become the Isabella Gianni hour.
Yeah.
I'm here for exactly. It. It's fine.
Yeah, there should be more of them.
So to go back to the film, and I guess pretty much conclude the recording, I don't know if you've got any final thoughts on the film. I suppose my last thing would be that I think its depiction of a town was very beautiful. And in that depiction, you see some of Herzog's kind of mad grandeur at times, you know, in those overhead shots. You see that kind of taste for the outsize, which makes some of his projects sort of feel quite crazed and exciting. That was probably the last thing I had to say.
Well, I've got, I think, two things I'd want to say. I assume everybody who's listening to this has already seen the film, so I'm not going to be doing spoilers if I talk about the end.
They fucking should have.
Exactly. All right. So, you know, you've only got yourselves to blame if this comes as a spoiler. But I love the fact that the vampire wins.
Yeah.
And I think that's not talked about enough. I mean, how many films do you see where the quote unquote bad guy gets away with it? You know, Harker turns into a vampire and Lucy's sacrifice was completely pointless because the vampire wins. He rides off into the sunset to do his unspecified vampire work and it's all going to begin again. And in a sense, it negates the film and her sacrifice becomes futile. It redeems Dracula, but her husband continues it. And I just think this is actually a really radical thing. It's very hard to find. I mean, you know, the end of Fight Club is quite similar in that the plan goes through. You expect the plan to be stopped, but the plan goes through. And it's just not a trope we see in film very much. And I think that's, in a sense, one of the most interesting parts of the whole film, that we don't get the redemptive sunrise. Well, we do, but then it's completely undermined by a new vampire being unleashed upon the world. And I love it. I love that subversion.
Yes, and it's in a shot as well that isn't especially disquieting. It's rather beautiful seeing him gallop off into the distance. It's not sort of done in a kind of horrifying way, you know, like a kind of gotcha.
Yeah. No, it's just this kind of off he goes. He rides off into the sunset, I suppose, you know, being a vampire.
Yeah.
And it's just quietly there. But the implications of that are, you know, once you think them through, it's quite astounding.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love that. And then my other, this is like a tiny bit of trivia that I've never seen written up, but I'm pretty sure it's true, which is that they use this incredible Georgian song throughout the film.
And yes, it's the music shit, yes.
Yes, through this incredible, you know, this dance through the plague. And when I first saw it, the film, I went, I know this piece of music because Kate Bush uses it in the song Hello Earth on the B-side of The Hounds of Love on the ninth wave. There's a clip of it from Hello Earth, and I swear, you know, she's so influenced by film. Her Wuthering Heights is taken from the film, not the book. I'm pretty sure she saw this and it's lodged and she's used it in Hello Earth. So that's my, you know,
romantic
dreamy ladies connection.
I love it. What year is Hounds of Love?
Hounds of Love is 1986.
Right, yeah. So that would fit. I love it. What a great bit of trivia. Fantastic. I probably should have mentioned the music a bit before. I mean, I found the use of music super interesting as well. But maybe that's for...
And the use of choir too. You know, so much of the film is not soundtracked, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of hush, isn't there, and of contemplation in counterpoint to the kind of rather hallowed use of music throughout. Fascinating. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, this has been a complete joy. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Why don't you stay on the line with me after I've hit stop, and we can say bye then. But that's the end of the program for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm saving that. That's done.